Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper to get the answers to your questions. Return back to normal this month after the election. So remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this month, she will be back again very soon. Now, the talk of the town at the moment seems to be haircuts, Daisy. I asked Bambos Charalambos about this, of his experience being back at the barbers. He said it wasn't that positive. How would you rate your experience?
That's a real shame. What happened to Bambos? Why didn't he have a good haircut?
He said that possibly the mask muffled his voice, but a little bit too much was taken off. I thought he looked rather sharp, but you never know.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I might message him about that. I'm very chuffed with my post-lockdown haircut. I had a lovely chat with, I probably shouldn't say her name, but without her permission, but a lovely lady from London Coney who cut my hair. And we had a chat about all things love life and life under lockdown and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I had a lovely haircut. The hair looks all right, I think. Good haircut and good chat.
Yeah, I mean, did it feel nice to be almost back to normal? Was that one of the first things that you felt, goodness me, life is returning back to how it once was?
I'll be honest, I haven't really had that sensation. I think because we know that we're not out of the woods yet and there's still a lot of uncertainty ahead. You know, there's still a lot of information that we're trying to find out about the Indian variant and how transmissible it is and whether the vaccine will work against it. So I think, like other people, I'm being quite tentative. I'm enjoying the fact that I can see a few people, you know, in small groups. I'm enjoying the fact I can go and get my hair cut. But I have to be honest, I personally don't really feel like things have gone back to normal as before. You know, we're still wearing masks, we're still hand sanitizing, we're still being a little bit cautious about, you know, distancing and only meeting in small groups. So I don't really have that sensation that we're getting back to normal yet, but I am enjoying the fact, obviously, that we can do a few more things and we're not just sort of cooped up at home with a half an hour slot to go for a walk.
Well, just continuing this, obviously lockdown has lifted a little, so you can go out. Have you been able to do this with friends, family, relax a little bit and actually help out local businesses?
Oh, well, it probably won't surprise you to know that I've been to the pub a few times. You know, I'm a big supporter of our pubs locally and I have been to a few of those. Went to the Eid market, the food market in town last week, the first of its kind, and that had a real, real buzz. And it was lovely to see so many people, you know, out and about. And of course, it is so safe to be out and about outside as well. So that was lovely. I haven't been to as many local retail shops as I'd like to, simply because I've been sort of quite busy campaigning on weekends, you know, up to the local elections. But now that those are over, hopefully I can sort of pop into town and have a bit of a mill about.
I mean, I do have to ask, did you pour a pint again, or have you just been on the other end, just having a few of St. Albans finest?
COVID rules do not allow me to go behind a bar and pull a pint, I'm afraid. So no, I haven't been doing that. I've been scanning the code, I've been sitting outside, and I've been waiting for people to bring the pints to me.
Oh, well, at least you can have a little bit of relax in the time that you have had off. But as you described there, it has been quite frantic leading up to this May month of voting. And we do have to start off locally. It has been good news for your party as the St. Albans Liberal Democrats team has taken control of the St. Albans District Council. How excited were you to hear about this and how was this victory achieved?
Yeah, it's really exciting. We were sort of leading the council already for the last, you know, since 2019, and we were doing that with the support of other local parties like Labour, Greens and Independents. So we were already leading the council, but because we had to get the support of other parties, that can lead to a lack of certainty, particularly for the officers who work at the council in terms of the direction of travel and whether policies that are being proposed might change and all the rest of it. So the fact that we now have majority control means that we can continue with our agenda, we can continue with fighting the climate emergency, continue with the climate projects, continue with building the social housing we need and investing in community facilities. But it means that we can come up with policies and have more certainty around them. So we'll continue to work cross-party. It's just very exciting news because I think it means that the people of St. Albans have seen the good work that Liberal Democrats can do when they're running the council.
I do have to ask about the actual process of electioneering during COVID, because it's a fascinating time. Obviously, it's changed a lot of how we do normal things. Liberal Democrats normally have the door knocker name, don't you? And you kind of very hands-on, positive and proactive in your approach. But how did this doorstep approach change during these COVID times?
Yeah, it's been a very strange campaign during the pandemic. So, you know, we pride ourselves as Lib Dems of being in touch all year round, you know, and we go and knock on doors all throughout the year. You know, I think a couple of years ago I had, or and the year before I had my sort of 1,000 door challenge, which is something I do in the summer and make sure I knock on 1,000 doors and speak to lots of people. So we do it all year round, not just at election time. But of course, it's been really tricky for the last year and a half because of COVID. We were all hoping to get back to door knocking, speaking to residents in January. But of course, we went into the lockdown then. And the government said that even though pizza companies could deliver pizza leaflets, political parties were not allowed to deliver political leaflets. So you can make of that what you will. But it did mean that we had to spend sort of the money that we managed to raise on posting leaflets rather than delivering them through volunteers. But we were allowed to knock on doors from the 8th of March. Understandably, there were a few people who were a little bit nervous about opening the door, quite understandably, because maybe they were still shielding or they'd only had one of their jabs or none of them at that point. And we were very conscious of that. So we made sure that all our volunteers knocked on the door, took two or three steps back to make sure that they were socially distanced, kept their mask on at all times, and hand sanitized regularly, you know, between doors as well. I guess the other thing that was a real shame is that when we go out knocking on doors, we often start with a big group. So we get a big group of people together and it's quite fun. And we can say, these are the conversations we're going to have. These are the kind of people we're speaking to today. And then we all go off and knock on doors and then we all come back and maybe pile into a cafe or a pub garden to, you know, have a chat. And people say, oh, I spoke to this person and they said that. And it can be a really fun, experience. But of course, this time round, we had to sort of door knock on our own. We couldn't do it with anybody else because of social distancing. And when we were allowed to meet in groups, it was a maximum of six. So that kind of group activity that we normally have was impacted. But the flip side of all of that was that a lot more people were at home because they were working from home. And so when we did knock on doors, we had a lot more people in who were able to answer the call and have a bit of a chat. And I think many people, actually the vast majority of people, were just really, really pleased to see us.
Well, just continuing on that trend there, I remember discussing with you a little bit earlier in lockdown and everything that you were calling residents just to check up on them. Was it nice to put a name to a face in some of these situations when you went door knocking and you realised, oh, I've chatted to them a little bit earlier?
Yeah, it was lovely. And a few people did mention it, actually. There's one chap, I won't give you his full name, but a guy called Colin. And we knocked on his door and he said, oh, he said, you know, it's one of your volunteers called me during lockdown. He said, it was so lovely just to know that somebody cared and that I could contact somebody and they gave me some contact details of something I needed, et cetera, et cetera. But he said, it was really nice to see you on the doorstep now, et cetera. So it was very sweet. So we called thousands of people during lockdown just to check on them, see if they had all the support they needed. And it was really nice that to see people after all this time and to hear people's various sort of different lockdown stories.
So let's switch the focus on to countrywide approach here. There's been a lot of positivity. You yourself gave a rousing speech on the Liberal Democrats crumbling the Conservative blue wall in the South. Has this been a good step forward towards a general election campaign, or is it too soon to consider this?
Well, political wonks and people in the political bubble in Westminster are always talking about the next general election, even starting from the day after a general election. So it's definitely something that some people are talking about. I think for most ordinary folk who have, you know, busy lives, many of them didn't even realise it was the local elections a couple of weeks ago, so they won't be thinking about the next general election. But I guess as an MP, it's always sort of it's always in our minds, you know, thinking ahead to the next set of elections. I think it does bode well for us. You know, I mean, overall, Liberal Democrats made some big steps forward in some key areas. We can now see that Liberal Democrats are running Cambridgeshire County Council, for example, in coalition with other parties, I think Labour and Green. The same is happening in Oxfordshire as well. I think possibly the first time ever in its history that Oxfordshire has had a leader that isn't a Conservative. I think even Peterborough possibly has gone into no overall control with Lib Dems and Labour possibly working together there. So, you know, there are some really good steps forward, and hopefully some of that good luck will come to Hertfordshire too over the next few years.
just on this discussion point here of, you know, a relatively good election campaign for the Liberal Democrats here. There's been talk, obviously, in comparison to other parties, namely Labour. Now, a lot of people have said that Keir Starmer hasn't been able to communicate supposed core values. How do you think that the Liberal Democrats have actually done this and been successful telling people its message? Do you believe that it's genuineness from the party leadership, such as yourself?
Well, I think one of the issues that Labour has, which is something I said when Keir Starmer was actually elected as leader, was that irrespective of who the leader is, there are some fairly deep splits in that party, and clearly they're going through a bit of a process of trying to work out, you know, what it is that they do stand for and what their principles and their offering to the country are going to be. And that's something that, you know, the Labour Party will have to do. From my side of things, I think you know, Liberal Democrats, you know, we are a smaller party, there's no denying that, we're acutely aware of that, but we've been very strong in our messaging, I believe, in areas where we've been able to move forward. We went into the local elections in St Albans, for example, talking about the fact that we'd declared the climate emergency, that we were building social housing, that we were investing in community facilities, and we explained our track record and explained what more we wanted to do in those three areas, and I think people responded to that.
So just continuing the talk there, you've talked that there is a coalition across the country in certain places. And the one that I actually wrote down was Milton Keynes, Labour Liberal Democrat Coalition. Is this some of kind of alliance that you will see possibly the parties going towards in terms of the general election? I know we've mentioned it there, and of course it's a bit preemptive, but some people have talked in hushed tones about a grand alliance of the Greens, Liberals and Labour Party.
Well, first thing I should say is you just mentioned Milton Keynes, and I mentioned Peterborough by mistake. What I meant to say was Milton Keynes, not Peterborough. So you go back to the earlier question, I think I got that wrong. Yeah, it's Milton Keynes where they're working together. It's far too early to say. It's really far too early to say. Nobody ever knows what the fault lines of a general election are going to be until a few months out. And until you know what the fault lines are, until you know what side of the dividing line a particular party is on, it's impossible to say to what extent you can work with them or work against them. But, you know, it's our number one goal as Liberal Democrats to play our part in getting rid of this Conservative government, because we believe they've moved so far to the right that they are out of touch. I think with, you know, they've kind of lost their traditional Conservative base and moving very much more to the right. And so it's our goal to, you know, win as many seats at the next general election. But, you know, anything else in terms of, you know, who we may or may not work with or how, I mean, these are questions for another day. We've still got, you know, several years to go.
Just on this issue of parties going more towards the right, there seems to be an Overton window shifting with all the parties, because some Labour critics have actually said that the party's moving far to the right for its own members. When I asked Bambos Charalambos about this, he said that the party was still dedicated to its core values. But do you feel that the Liberal Democrats are fast becoming the only party for centre and left moderate voices?
Well, it's funny, this sort of phrase centre, left and right, you know, it's a sort of a variable thing, isn't it? You know, it's a spectrum, people see themselves on different ends of the spectrum. I mean, the fact is that Liberal Democrats believe fundamentally in freedom. And we don't believe that people can be free to lead their lives as they choose if they're living in poverty, if they can't access the education skills that they need, or if they're being told to live their life in a particular way. They should have the freedom to decide that. So those are our core principles. I guess using that left-right spectrum, we are a centre-left party. We always have been. And those are the kind of values that we would espouse. We are internationalists, we are environmentalists, we're pro-business, we're pro-public services. These are our values. And I guess depending on where the other parties move along the spectrum, we are variably described as being on the centre left or in the centre, or, you know, it all kind of moves around a little bit. But I mean, our values are fairly consistent, and there are things that have been in our manifesto for, you know, for decades, because our values are pretty fixed.
Just continuing about the values of the party, The Guardian wrote that politicians supporting universal basic income have fared well in these elections, and the tones around proportional representation seem to be growing with politicians embracing the idea. One of the most notable ones this week was actually Andy Burnham. Does this make you feel happy that the Lib Dem party's ideas are getting out there, becoming more mainstream? Or are you a bit annoyed that maybe others are seen to be taking your ideas?
Well, as a small party, the Lib Dems, it's not unusual for us to see our ideas being picked up by the other parties. And it doesn't irk me at all. You know, you get into politics because you want things to change, right? It's not necessarily about always getting the credit for them. And you actually do want things to change. And I think that the concept of a universal basic income, as it's currently called, it can be called lots of other things as well. Some people call it sort of a negative income tax or a, you know, basic income guarantee, whatever you want to call it. But the basic idea that there should be a threshold below which nobody should fall. And the idea that everybody should know that they have a basic level of income that they will always have, so they're never left with zero income, I think is a really brilliant idea. And I know that the Welsh government has indicated that it wants to run a trial of universal basic income. I've given my support to a motion in Parliament just today calling on the Westminster government to support the Welsh government to be able to do that in terms of linking up various, you've got to link up HMRC and DWP and all those kind of different government departments. But I think it's fundamentally a good idea. And I think we should do the trial and see what the results are. There are trials that have been done of a universal basic income in other countries. And what they show is that people's well-being goes up because they're less worried about money and they're less worried about having zero money. That actually there's no people don't have a disincentive to work. In fact, what it actually encourages them to do, it gives them the security of knowing that if they're not enjoying their job or they want to move to a different sector because that's something where they're going to be more effective and more productive in economic terms, that actually they have the confidence to do that. So it's actually, it's arguably a really good thing in tackling poverty, but it's also a really good thing from encouraging entrepreneurship and encouraging that kind of dynamism that you need in a competitive economy as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing a trial. I hope the Westminster government does everything it needs to support the Welsh government in doing it, and we'll see what the results are.
This month, you have been supporting students across the country. You asked the university ministers what plans there were to provide financial compensation to university students for loss of teaching and rent through this pandemic. They set a May timeline for which things should be happening, and you raised your concerns that it was too little, too late. But what steps have actually been put in place to help students, and do you feel that the right things are being done now?
No, I don't. The government is way behind on this once again. So the one thing that the government has done is to set up a sort of, what's it called? Not a wellbeing fund, but a hardship fund. Sorry, it's a hardship fund. And under pressure from opposition parties, including the Lib Dems, they have increased the amount of money in the hardship fund. But it's still a fraction of what students in Wales and Scotland, for example, have received from the hardship fund set up by those governments. The one thing the government has done nothing on, really, it's giving compensation or sorting out a framework for students to get compensation. Now, we've seen that in almost every single sector, there's been support. There's been, you know, there's been the furlough scheme for businesses. There's been business rates holidays. There's been a freezing of evictions. Lots of people have had support, but they haven't had the financial resources to pay for things. And the government, for whatever reason, seems to have drawn a red line when it comes to students. Now, some universities have been trying to do what they can. The response of universities has been incredibly varied, and the responses have been, you know, some have been very, very impressive and very good in terms of the support they've offered their students, both financially and but also, you know, mental health and other sort of teaching support. But other universities are really lagging behind in terms of doing that. And so there's a real kind of potluck system in place for students. And what I've been calling for as the Lib Dem education spokesperson is for the government to actually set out a framework as to how universities should, you know, a minimum level by which universities should be trying to work with students, and that the government should step in with the funds. Because if you leave it to universities to compensate students, the problem you have is that some of those universities might very quickly become financially unviable, and then you see them suddenly see the collapse of many of our higher education institutions, many of which are world renowned. So we need the government to step up and support universities and students to do this. And the, you know, the rise in the number of students that are having to eat from food banks is staggering, because not only can they not learn and they're having to pay out for their bills, but they can't work either. And a lot of students do work when they're at university. So I'll continue to bang the drum on this particular issue. But the government seems at the moment to be digging its heels in and refusing to act. But we'll keep pushing.
Does it anger you that there's more focus from the government on discussions about free speech at universities rather than focusing on the students, as you've described, they're being put in financial precarious positions?
Yes and no. So I am a free speech advocate. I worked for, you know, I worked for Hacked Off, a campaign group, for 4 years where we were campaigning for a free and accountable press. So free speech is an issue that I think is incredibly important and needs to be protected at all times. The fact is that I don't think that's what the government's bill on free speech is actually going to do. The government says it's concerned about no platforming, when in reality I think there were just 6 events possibly out of 10,000 or something where, you know, where even the question of no platforming was even taken into account. So I think the concept of free speech is important, and I think it's incumbent on any government, the government of the day, to protect free speech. But the government's legislation, which it claims it's bringing forward to protect free speech, I think is unnecessary, because all of the fundamental legal principles underpinning free speech are already there. They're already there in law. They're fairly robust. And what the government's legislation is trying to do is effectively trying to create a sort of the thought police through the Office for Students in terms of checking up on universities and whether they're actually abiding by their existing laws. So what I would prefer, and I think this is what your question was getting at, is I would prefer the Education Secretary of State and all of the ministers to focus on things like sorting out child poverty, sorting out free school meals in schools, sorting out compensation for university students who have had a rough time. These are the things that it should be focusing on, not bringing in legislation that is not needed and may actually be very damaging to free speech.
Well, let's continue this discussion on free speech, because the university's minister, Michelle Donnellan, earlier this month spoke to Radio 4, and she actually shocked many people across the country, explaining how we must promote and protect free speech, even if that is to protect Holocaust deniers. The government's new university free speech law would not just protect Holocaust denial. This is what Michelle Donnellan explained. It would also compensate those who advocate it and are then cancelled from university events. This would go against the government policy of asking universities to bring in the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, and also against the Conservative Party policy, which actually includes that IHRA definition. And under that, it says denying the fact, scope, mechanisms, or internationality of the genocide of Jewish people at the hands of the National Socialist Germany and its supporters is anti-Semitic in itself. This is deeply upsetting for many. Will the Liberal Democrats pressure the government over this?
In short, yes, we will. Let me be blunt. Her interview is absolutely shocking. Her seniors in terms of the Secretary of State has said that she was wrong to say what she said, and I do think it's a sign that she's out of her depth, because she does not understand even what the government's own laws will or won't do. And I think it was incredibly distressing to a number of people, particularly those in the Jewish community, but very distressing to a number of people to hear what she had to say. And I completely denounce what she had to say. And if there is any wiggle room at all in this new bill that allows for what she said it's going to allow, we will oppose it very, very strongly. But I think it's important to set out what the current state of the law is. There is a human right for free speech. Free speech does not mean that you can say absolutely anything you want. There are existing restrictions on free speech. So you can't libel somebody, for example, and you can't give hate speech either. And if somebody is speaking to, is either expressing or inciting religious or racial hatred, that is already subject to the law, and they can be fined or imprisoned for doing that. So there are restrictions on free speech, and the idea that free speech means that anybody can say anything at all whenever they want, wherever they choose, is not correct. So there are already restrictions. Part of the problem we have in the UK is that Holocaust denial is not actually illegal. and I think that it needs to be. And so I would like to see changes either through this piece of legislation or ideally through other pieces of legislation that make it clear that Holocaust denial is part of that religious and racial hatred, and is part of that camp where it can be tackled through existing mechanisms. But I think it was, very shocking what she said. And I think she doesn't understand the current state of the law. And I think it's, given what she has said, it's going to be really important that we make sure that whatever this new bill is, whatever it looks like, we do make sure that there isn't any room in there for Holocaust denial to either be allowed or for it for people to be compensated. As I say, I don't think that was even the government's own intentions, not that I'm one to normally defend the government. So I think, as I say, it shows that she's woefully out of her depth. But if there's any scope whatsoever for what she said to actually be permitted under this new legislation, we will absolutely oppose it. And we do oppose this bill at the moment in the way that it's currently worded.
So continuing with your work within Parliament, this month you played an integral role in the Climate Policy Dashboard. Explain how this will hold governments to account over keeping to environmental targets going forward.
So I'm really proud of this little thing. It's great. So one of the first things I did when I was elected, actually, was to get myself elected again into the Climate Change All-Party Parliamentary Group. This is a forum where MPs of different political parties come together, you know, around a shared concern for climate change and the climate emergency. And it's been a really interesting year, because we've heard from lots of different experts, we've met lots of different groups, but obviously we're coming up later in this year, we're coming up to the UN Global Climate Summit, which is going to be in the UK. And I felt it was really important that we, as a cross-party group, could measure to what extent the government's announcements were going to match up to what we actually need to do. So, you know, a huge amount of work needs to be done to tackle the climate emergency. You know, we've now got less than 9 years to stop irreversible damage to the planet, and we are woefully behind on where we need to be. Now, in the run-up to any particular sort of big meeting, you often have lots of different governments making lots of different announcements about all the things they're going to do, and you hear very big numbers, you know, millions of this and billions of that and this much money and this many goals and this many trees and all that kind of thing. And I thought it was really important for transparency that the public, as well as MPs and commentators and journalists, could see in a very clear form what the government needs to be doing to get to net zero compared with what it's preparing to do and what it has announced it's going to do. And so I proposed this to the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Climate Change. They all agreed it was a good idea. There's a think tank called Policy Exchange which went away and then designed this particular dashboard, and it's now on their website. And it's a very simple representation where across six areas of the economy, they have ranked the government out of 10 as to how well the government's policies match up to what the government needs to be doing. And in one area, I think it's energy. I think that's the best performing area. They've given the government 6 out of 10. And I think in the worst area, that I think is waste and recycling, it's about 2 out of 10. I'm saying all of this from memory, so hopefully I'm not too far off the mark. But it's a really, really simple tool for people to look at online, for organisations to use and for us to use to see what announcements come out of the government over the next few months and then see whether those announcements go far enough. So I'll certainly be using it quite a lot and then using it to inform all the things that I then ask the government to do to tackle the climate emergency over the next few months.
Yeah, I think one of the amazing things about this policy dashboard is it's so accessible. It's really easy to understand. And as you said there, I think your numbers are spot on from the last time that I checked it for this. I do have a follow-up question actually about that 2 out of 10 on waste disposal. And recently the Guardian actually explained that I think 55% of the world's non-renewable, non-recyclable, single-use plastic comes from just 20 companies. I mean, what is the government going to do about that?
No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you'd need to ask the government, but the Conservative government did spend a lot of time developing a waste strategy quite a few years ago. I don't say a few years ago, sort of before I was elected, around 2017, 2018, I think. And part of that waste strategy was going to be looking at the use of non-recyclable plastics. And you know, Liberal Democrats are clear. We just think that non-recyclable plastics need to be banned and, you know, phased out over a very short period of time, 2 or 3 years, and then banned altogether, with a few exceptions where you need them for things like, you know, medical procedures and things like that. But by and large, you know, I think the public, there's an overwhelming demand from the public to see non-recyclable plastics just banned, and the government so far hasn't taken strong enough action to do that. So we do have a problem with the fact that we are using lots of things that can't be recycled, and there's still a problem with some of our waste being exported abroad as well. So clearly, despite the government spending a few years developing a new waste strategy, it hasn't really made any tangible difference to what we need to be doing, or hasn't made a big contribution to what we need to be doing to get up to net zero by tackling our waste emissions.
So you've mentioned there, discussing what the community wants to know, and this is what we do here at Radio Verulam. So as always, we ask for questions for you from the community. So the first one is from David, and he said, can you please ask Daisy when St Albans can have access to a fit for purpose hospital with A&E? Watford is not. Also, is the minor injuries opening up again at St Albans Hospital?
Sure. So I suppose that David will probably know the most recent update, which is that West Hearts Hospital Trust is an entirely independent organisation. The West Hearts Hospital Trust has run a public consultation and it has decided it is going to proceed with the upgrading of the three hospitals, Watford, Hemel and St Albans. As part of that process, the main upgrade is going to be at Watford because it's bigger, but St Albans Hospital will be upgraded as well. We are not going to get an A&E. That was never part of the plan. So that isn't going to happen. But we are going to get some fantastic new resources, particularly for cancer diagnosis and treatment. And that's something that I wish West Hertfordshire Hospital Trust would talk about a little bit more, because we are going to get some fantastic diagnosis services. And the reorganisation of services means that it should be more of a one-stop shop. So at the moment, when people go for various tests, they often have to go to Hemel for one bit of the test and St Albans for another bit of the test and Watford for another bit of the test to get a proper diagnosis. And actually, by reorganising some of those services, it should be possible for people to go to the local hospital and get all the tests done that they need to for a particular diagnosis. So that's a really exciting improvement. The minor injuries unit was closed at the start of the pandemic because the lockdown restrictions meant that people were told to stay at home, and as a result there just weren't very many minor injuries. We were all told to not get in the car, not use power tools, stay at home, sit on the sofa, don't injure yourself. And as a result, there was really hardly any demand whatsoever on the minor injuries unit. So they closed it down on a temporary basis so that they could reallocate the staff to Watford to help fight COVID. And to date, the minor injuries unit is still sort of temporarily closed. There was always going to be a longer term plan to look at the minor injuries unit and work out whether or not it was sort of fit for purpose or not. There is a national plan from the NHS nationally, which is to transform minor injuries units into urgent treatment centres, effectively, where there's a much broader variety of medical assistance that you can get. So at the moment, the minor injuries unit remains sort of temporarily closed. I genuinely don't know whether it's going to reopen or not as a minor injuries unit, but in the full course of time, it's very likely that it will be transformed into something like an urgent treatment centre. And that means that actually there would be continuing medical care for those that need it, and it would cater for more things over and above just injuries. So there will be some form of support there at St Albans, but it's more likely going to be an urgent treatment centre, not just a minor injuries unit.
And what about David's concerns about A&E? What kind of advice can you give him for which hospital he should visit, or with these plans, is anything going to be done about that issue?
Well, it depends which part of St Albans he's in. Some parts of St Albans people prefer to go to the A&E at Watford, and depending on if they live in other parts of St Albans, they might prefer to go to A&E at a different hospital. But Watford, for a large part of the constituency and for the area, is the closest one. The fact is that there is a public consultation, I think, going on at the moment. I don't think it's closed. I need to double check that. But the Hospital Trust is consulting the public for their views on the accessibility and other issues around A&E. I'm very much of the view that once the upgrade to all the hospitals happens, we do need to look at transport in particular. I know that there are older people in St Albans in particular who may not drive or have their own car, and they often struggle to get to the hospital for visiting, and that's something that I'll definitely be picking up. But as I say, the Hospital Trust has decided that it's going to be upgrading all three hospitals, and I would just encourage him and other people with concerns to take part in the public consultations that happen.
Mary has messaged in saying, Daisy, I want to thank you for your tireless campaigning for justice over Grenfell and other tower blocks in similar danger. The recent government action must be a blow to you, and as you said, nearly 4 years on the Grenfell tragedy, millions of homeowners are still living in death traps. How many St Albans residents are affected, and with the Lib Dems winning the council, will you oversee help for these residents?
So first thing to say is it's hard to give a definitive number on how many people in St Albans are affected, because there are still some blocks of flats that are waiting for the assessments as to what degree they are affected. So and also it's not just kind of are they affected or not, it's not a black and white thing. It's often that some of them will need some form of remediation. Maybe their balconies will need to be taken out and replaced with something else. Maybe there's cladding on the outside. Maybe it's the material in the floors or the ceilings between different apartments. And so there's still some places in St Albans where they're still waiting for those assessments to find out what category they're in. So it isn't possible to give a definitive answer on the exact number of people that are affected, but it's definitely in its hundreds. There are hundreds of people affected by this, and the residents at Opus House at Charrington Place in particular have been very vocal about this. They've taken part in local and national media to talk about just how scary it is for them. To be honest, this is a national government issue. It's not a local government issue. The issue at the national level is that the government has created something called a building safety fund. And I've been working with residents from a number of different blocks of flats across St Albans to put in applications to the building safety fund. Some have been successful, some are still waiting to be invited to apply. There's a huge amount of paperwork that's required. I'll be doing some work on this over the next few days, so I probably shouldn't spike my own story, but there are definitely complications in the way that the government's demands of what they expect companies and managing agents to do. And so it's not really for the council to tackle this. It is a national government issue, and that's why I'll continue to fight for it and fight for the affected residents in St Albans through my work in Parliament.
Well, I hope that answer is useful to Mary to understand where this is going directionally. But Andy has actually asked about a local issue that is really quite concentrated on the St Albans area, but he's very upset about it. He said, our historic cobbles were ripped up and taken away after works were done on St Albans Road. We residents protested this, as these have been in the city for more than 100 years and were replaced by ugly asphalt. Why was this allowed to happen, and will you oppose any similar measures that detract from the character of our town that must be preserved and is one of the reasons why tourists come to St Albans?
Yeah, I saw this story in the Heart Sad and contacted the local councillors about it, because it's a council matter, it's not a sort of parliamentary one. It's Gurney Court Road that's affected, and Gurney Court Road residents have got these beautiful cobbles which are part of the highways actually, but they are just at the point where people drive into their drives. So I think people have a great sense of ownership over them, because it's a lovely sort of defining feature as they drive into their driveways. So I asked the councillors about this when I saw the story, and what they said was that this is obviously that those cobbles are part of the highways, so it's a responsibility of Hertfordshire County Council. About 15 years ago, I think Hertfordshire County Council changed their highways policy so that they would, whenever they were doing repairs to a highway, they would always replace it with something that was more cost effective, as long as it was outside of the conservation area. So where we have a conservation area in the centre of the city, those areas will be protected. But outside of the conservation area, it is the Hertfordshire County Council policy to replace, you know, whatever, whether it's, you know, cobbles or pavement slabs or whatever it is, it's to replace it in the most, you know, financially viable way. So I know that a number of residents have contacted their local councillors, and their local councillors are working on it with the county council. But as I say, that is definitely a council issue and one to pick up with your local and your new Hertfordshire County councillor.
So moving on to a different David, this isn't the same one from earlier. He has asked, Daisy, you were recently quoted in the Hearts ad saying the government was trying to ram through the wrong kind of housing in the wrong places and doesn't give two jots about destroying Greenbelt or overriding the wishes of local people in the process. He explains that there's a highly contentious planning application to build 150 houses with a view to more in the absence of a local plan. He quotes the council reference, which I will send to you, but he says that more than 210 people have taken the time to comment to object to this proposal, which would add traffic to a highly congested road and destroy precious Greenbelt land. He said, could you please comment on your view of this application of using Greenbelt for such developments rather than exploring the possibilities of repurposing brownfield sites?
So the comments that I initially made were about the government's proposals to bring in a new planning law. And under the government's proposed new planning laws, they would change the way in which local people got to have a say on anything. So at the moment, local councils have to develop a local plan, which sets out where they want to build new developments, whether that's houses or anything else. And then local people get to have a say on that. And then specific planning applications come forward and the public get to have a say on that as well. Under the government's proposals, people would only get a say on the kind of in theory design of the local plan, but they wouldn't get a say on individual planning applications. And I am fundamentally opposed to the idea of reducing local scrutiny so that people don't have a say. I think it's absolutely outrageous. And you know, there's a number of actual Conservative MPs, Conservative backbenchers, who are equally as alarmed by what the government is proposing, because there wouldn't be any restrictions on pushing through lots of housing on the Greenbelt. And I think what we have is we have a government that simultaneously says it wants to protect the Greenbelt whilst also giving out these enormous housing targets not reconciling the two. And in a place like St Albans, where about 96% of our district is classified as Greenbelt, you know, whilst we're also being told to build 16,000 homes a year or whatever it is, you know, this is we can't do all of this whilst protecting the Greenbelt. So the two things are inconsistent. With respect to this particular planning application, again, planning applications go to the local district council. So this is a council matter, it's not a parliamentary matter. But I do know from speaking to my councillor colleagues that a number of residents have contacted their local district councillors. And the two Lib Dem councillors for that area have called in that application. And by calling it in, what that means is that a decision won't be made by an officer who's an employee of the council. It'll have to be scrutinised by a committee of elected councillors, and people who object and people who want to advocate for it both get to have their say and get to be heard by the committee. And anybody who is concerned should contact their district councillors. And I'm sure that, you know, given the chance, some of the residents and perhaps the councillors as well will get to have their say at that particular planning hearing.
Now, Angela is talking about a different type of problem. Well, I don't think it's even a problem as such. She said that she saw your post on the Sopwell Community Garden and Grow Community Sopwell. She said, how's the problems of flooded allotments been sorted? Also, do you grow any veg yourself? What are your favourites? And she says her apologies for so many questions.
That's quite okay. Don't worry, Angela. So I actually popped down to, I had a little look at the allotments, just through the gates in Sopwell, just to have a look. And the vast majority of the allotments have had the water drain away. But the issue we have is that there have been, you know, there's been so much rain over the last year, huge, huge volumes of rain, that the groundwater is now incredibly high. And it means that, you know, there's no space for the water to drain away. So every time we get another rainfall, the water rises again. I have been chasing the Environment Agency because they were supposed to go down to the Cotton Mill allotments and check the riverbank in particular, because water was coming through two or three different places, and that was something they were going to be looking at. And I, to the best of my knowledge, that hasn't happened yet, and I'm still chasing the Environment Agency to go down, because it is their responsibility to go down and check it. Some people who have allotments down there will know there's a much bigger and more long-standing issue, which is how we protect that particular set of allotments, because it is the lowest point of land there. It's also sort of the natural direction for the river as well. I think the river used to run through the middle of the allotments, and I think it's fighting back and trying to get back in there. So there is a longer term issue about how we look after those allotments, but the short term issue, which is around the sort of the enormous amounts of groundwater plus repairing that riverbank, they're not sorted yet, but we're continuing to chase. Oh, and as for any veg, did she ask, do I grow any veg myself?
Yes, she asked, which do you grow any veg and which are your favourites?
I don't grow any veg myself, but it's one of those things that I want to get round to doing. Probably for about the last 5 years of my life, I've been saying I should get round to planting some vegetables, and I haven't got round to it. So it was really nice actually to go down to the community garden and plant some there. I think I was planting leeks, and there was something else. Oh, white onions. There you go. That's what I planted.
So if you were to choose a favourite one that you really want to grow, like what's top of the Daisy wish list there?
Oh, potatoes for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have potatoes with everything.
I mean, I grow potatoes with my gran. We have like competitions with which kind of ones that I pick and she picks, and we kind of weigh and then we eat them all at the same time. It's really good fun. But yeah,
amazing.
Yeah, it's one of those good things about growing your own veg and allotments and everything. On to another positive story. And Sarah says, in lockdown, you help save Watford Hospital. But are you excited about Watford FC's promotion to the Premier League?
Ah, so I didn't save the hospital. I did help sort out the oxygen supply. I had to just make sure I don't have to overclaim on that one. I think it's brilliant whenever any of our local football teams get promoted. I have to say, I'm pretty chuffed that Coney Heath football team's also had a promotion. So I'm going to just put in a little plug for them as well as Watford.
Yes, well, Coney Heath are one of Radio Verulam's teams that we like to commentate on. So, yeah, there's really good news around Hertfordshire at the moment. St Albans City were playing really well before, unfortunately, the league got cancelled. Coney Heath, really well done to them. But let's move the conversation on to the final question. And I think this is an exciting one. I'm looking forward to it. But as a Europhile, will you be watching Eurovision this weekend? Will you support the UK, or has another song caught your attention?
Do you know what? I always say every single year, oh, I'm not going to watch Eurovision. I'm not going to watch it. And then I put the TV on and I get sucked in. It's like a real guilty pleasure. You start watching it and you just can't peel yourself away because some of the songs are just so completely and utterly nuts. So probably in the same spirit as every year, I'll probably say that I'm not going to watch it. And then I'll put the TV on. And if I spot it, I'll probably get sucked in. I probably will end up watching it. And of course, I'll be supporting the UK. Yeah, always.
I mean, I'll be supporting the UK, but I've also got a favourite song in Bulgaria. And what my friends and I like to do is make dishes of the country that we're supporting that year. So we'll be doing it over Zoom, eating dishes. I've got a Bulgarian dish in mind. But it's good that you're a Eurovision fan. And just moving it on then, as always, Daisy, thank you for your time. Just a reminder for people that if you didn't have your question answered by Daisy this month, you'll be returning next month. But for now, just a huge thanks for your time in answering the community questions.
No problem.